This is The Capital Corner, a McGuire Woods podcast exploring investment strategies, capital structures, and topics relevant in today's middle market private equity. Join McGuire Woods partner Jeff Cockrell as he and specialists share practical insights to inform your deal work.
Thank you. This is Jeff Cockrell. I'm glad you could join us with another episode of the Corner Series, where we bring together kind of thought leaders, deal makers, and professionals in the healthcare private equity investing arena to talk about more specific and nuanced aspects of investing. Today, we're thrilled to be joined by Bijan Salahizadeh from Navamed Capital. And Navamed is a middle market investor in private equity and life science businesses. Bijan, maybe give a little bit of introduction of yourself and what you all are doing at Navamed Capital.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. And happy to be on and really a big fan of the podcast that you're putting together here. So as you said, Navamed Capital is a healthcare-only private equity investment firm. We're based in Washington, D.C. We are in the kind of the lower end of the middle market. Typical entry point for us is $1 to $10 million of EBITDA. And we have invest across the healthcare landscape, payer-provider, but also pharmaceutical services. Firm's been around for 8 or 9 years, and we're investing our second fund, which is about a $300 million fund, which is right-sized for the kinds of investment opportunities. We're one of the co-founders of the firm, and I got to private equity by a little bit of a circuitous background, trained as a physician up in New York, worked in industry for a few years in the healthcare industry, and then after more grad school, I got into the private equity investment business about 20 years ago.
Bijan, one of the areas where you're spending some time is in pharma services. I'm always interested to hear from investors kind of the investment thesis and maybe how you're segmenting that sector.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Pharma services has been, I think, really one of the, I wouldn't necessarily call it hidden, but really one of the growth sectors within healthcare PE for the last 5 to 10 years, I would say. And really is just as much so here at Navamed. The things that are driving that growth of interest from private equity are really structural things that start first and foremost with the growth in high quality science. Science leads to more drugs in the pipeline, more cures. And let's just frame what pharma services is. It's the outsourced services that the pharmaceutical and biotech industry use to get their drugs through the FDA approval process and often after the FDA approval process and getting those drugs commercialized. And it used to be 30, 40 years ago, all of that was done inside the biopharma company itself. There was very little outsourced. And really over the last 20 years or so, there's been this rapid move from the large pharmas and the small ones to outsource a bunch of their key functions. You know, up to 30, 40% of the R&D budget now is outsourced to outsourced providers, and an increasing portion of the commercialization budget for new drugs is outsourced to outsourced providers. The exact type of providers that private equity firms are buying and consolidating and then kind of selling up the chain. And the other thing that's been driving all of this, why has this been happening? There's been a lot of money inflow into the pharma industry itself, into those molecules. That's not where private equity invests. That's more of a venture capital IPO market thing, but it's been dramatic. Venture funding has been really growing over the last, you know, 15 or 20 years into biopharma behind tech. It's number two. And the IPO market, starting in 2013 through last year, there's been 500 new biotech IPOs, companies that have gone public on the NASDAQ or NYSE. And that's almost as much as went public in the prior 20 years have gone public in the last 8 years. So there's just a lot of supply of companies with a lot of cash developing a bunch of exciting science. And they've all realized that we don't need to hire. In fact, we can't hire the best and the brightest people to develop our drugs, which means how do you make them? How do you test them and get them through the FDA mandated clinical trials? It's hard to get those people hired internally. And so let's outsource that to a specialist who will do that on our behalf. And that has really driven the growth of this space. And now the, you know, sort of exactly what happens in lots of other industries like payer provider, a bunch of small outsourcers are consolidating, driven by private equity and being bought by strategics and bigger private equity.
It's also interesting to me, and it has some similar dynamics to provider services in the sense that we're both with biopharma and provider services. They're big markets, big sectors that investors would like to have kind of investment access and exposure to, but they have some characteristics that are challenging for them. On the provider services side, a lot of investors might be spooked a little bit by kind of government reimbursement and the liability and risk that comes with that aspect of it. But if they can kind of find an adjacent business that kind of supports them, they can kind of get access to the growth trajectory of that primary sector while avoiding some of the characteristics they don't like. And in biopharma, there's characteristics that can be challenging of with bio and pharma dominated by large players. A lot of the kind of access points have kind of binary outcome risk. If you can kind of park yourself a little bit adjacent, now all of a sudden you're in a cash flow business that's more typical for a private equity investor, and getting kind of exposure to that primary sector while avoiding some of the characteristics that they don't like. And that kind of opens up investment to a much wider array of types of investors. Is that kind of consistent with what you're seeing as far as investment participants?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jeff. And in fact, I think so much so that a good chunk of the money from private equity we notice that goes into outsourced pharmaceutical services, not just from healthcare groups or historical healthcare investors who've invested in payer or payer provider, but also from generalist business process outsourcing. Because at the end of the day, pharma services is a business process outsourcing type of investment. It's a lot of it is project-based businesses because you don't know what's happening with the pharma company's pipeline. They can wake up tomorrow morning and say, you know, the FDA said our trial has to stop or the science didn't work. So that's the risk of pharma services. But the benefit of pharma services is you're not subject to government reimbursement. And pharma is a good payer and pharma is a fast payer. And you also have, you know, pretty good pricing power, which I think in these inflationary times, a lot of the provider businesses don't have, because the way Medicare and reimbursement tends to work in the provider side of the world is there's a lag behind sort of your cost structure as a provider to what Medicare is willing to reimburse you. Pharma has a lot more pricing power, given most pharma companies, when they're commercial, are driving 80-90% gross margins. And so they have pricing power in how they want to deploy that capital into their R&D spend, which is often the budget that the kinds of businesses private equity invests in outsourcing, that's where the budget comes from.
What are some of the kind of economic growth thesis that you think about in pharma services? In provider services, it might be kind of multiple arbitrage of buying smaller things and putting them on a platform that then will trade at a higher multiple, or bringing in other ancillary services that a smaller organization couldn't fully tap into. What are some of the economic growth theses that you think about in pharma services?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, we tend to think of it, and different firms probably have different theses, but ours at the kind of small end of buyout, lower middle market, is a lot of revenue and cross-sell synergies. There are relatively few economic buyers inside the pharmaceutical company, and yet they have to outsource many different kinds of functions to get that drug approved. A whole bunch of buzzwords I won't use around the manufacturing process and the FDA and the clinical trial process. And one of the things that I think has held, a thesis that has held true in terms of the economic expansion potential, is you buy different areas within that, and you try to make the economic buyer inside of the biopharma company have the classic one vendor, one-stop shop kind of thesis. And that's worked out pretty well for us and for a lot of other investors in the space. You know, it's also the other driver here is there are a lot, and I mean a lot, this is what's similar to the provider business. There are just a lot of small outsourced providers that grew up with a niche. You know, almost think of them as little consulting firms that grew up with a niche. They're really good at this kind of trial or this kind of manufacturing process or this kind of commercialization process. And yet they can't scale above a certain level. And so putting together a best of breed type of offering, getting sort of sales synergies and cross sells is a really big economic driver. And then you get those things big enough at a scale that larger private equity in our world at NaviMed or the strategic buyers, which are what's called the CROs, the clinical research organizations, the publicly traded guys like IQVIA and some others, want to buy because they make economic sense. That's the rinse and repeat cycle. And when those things get bought, sometimes the founders of those things spin out, start all over again, and do another small little niche vendor. And that rinse and repeat cycle has happened now for almost 20 years. And it's sort of the industry tends to replenish itself in this world quite often.
For you and at NaviMed, what's kind of your entry point from a size and scale perspective?
Yeah, our entry point is a single-digit EBITDA, we call it. So often we're creating a platform by putting together two of those small $1 to $5 million EBITDA businesses that might have the same economic buyer inside of pharma, but on their own can't expand to the other's area. We often, but not always, bring in a new management team, CEO, CFO, head of sales to kind of run that effort. And, you know, our formula, if you had to sum it up, is put things together that aggregate to, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 million of EBITDA that have the right growth dynamic that we're looking for, the right double-digit growth dynamic, and hope to grow them with new management and the founders together working, and other add-on acquisitions over time, just things that are in kind of the 20 plus million EBITDA range that fit nicely inside of the larger PE firms who have the exact same thesis that we have, but want to take things with a bow on it that, you know, we've sort of done the business building professionalization part, because we're all only buying founder-backed, founder-owned businesses here at NaviMed. We're not buying to things that have been previously taken over by private equity and cleaned up. So we're doing a lot of that sort of business building. I almost call it seed stage private equity, because there's a lot of, you know, building that has to go on cash-based financials, no CFO, the idea of finances, tax, owner tax. There's no sales, there's no CRM like Salesforce. It's all been done by the owner in all these small-sized businesses, and we've got to come in and really kind of make it look like the kind of KPIs, dashboards, and business processes that we all are used to at PE.
What are some of the risks in this sector as you're investing? Is it kind of vertical integration by re-vertical integration by the biopharma companies? Is it finding out you had greater exposure to binary outcome risk? What are some of the risks that are inherent in this type of investing?
You named two of the big ones. You know, as and I think right now we might be entering the stage. We had a decade of lots of IPOs and lots of budgets to spend on outsourcing, and obviously the public markets have turned today as we record this in mid 2022, and I think that there will be a wave of M&A as the stock prices of the biopharmas. It's just part of the cycle. And that M&A might mean that there'll be vendor downselect or vendor recompetes. And the vendors are, of course, the kinds of companies that PE funds are backing. So that's something that's a risk. The biology is a risk. If, as I said, if the FDA or science says, you know, this molecule can't go on, well, you lose your budget. And so people, we try to account for that in the way we do backlog and pipeline. We put a discount factor. Historically, that's been about 20% of your projects go away in a given year for reasons that are entirely out of your control. And then the other risk that we always look at, especially at the size where we enter, is concentration risk. A lot of these smaller businesses, these consulting type businesses that have been formed around an outsourcing vector on behalf of pharma, you know, have started with one or two key relationships and have grown inside that particular client. And of course, that's something you have to think hard about, because things happen at clients. And so we try not to take anything greater than 10 or 20% customer concentration risk in any given business that we buy.
That's probably also an opportunity too, because those concentrations impact valuation, and a high degree of concentration in a small target, once they're folded into you, probably doesn't pose the same kind of concentration risk. So there seems probably opportunities in that arena as well.
Real opportunities for the add-on acquisitions that we make around that concentration, because as you said, that exact dynamic plays itself out once you fold it into the larger thing.
Super interesting area. Bijan, any other aspects of investing in pharma services that we haven't touched on that you want to raise?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing I would add to this, Jeff, is that I think we always think of pharma investing, and I think it's generally true, as relatively recession resistant. I wouldn't say recession proof, because I think nothing is really recession proof, but it's something we think about here in the middle of 2022 as sort of the macroeconomic conditions seem, you know, unstable. You know, the march of science goes on. The question is, what's the access to capital for the smaller kind of biotech companies? And of course, it's not just small companies. The large companies like Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson also outsource a lot of things. You would think with all the people these companies employ at a Pfizer size company, they wouldn't outsource. But in fact, they're some of the biggest users of outsourcing for some of the reasons I mentioned earlier. So that puts in some of the recession resistance. And then the other thing I would say is we lived through a recession in the great financial recession of 2009. And the part of pharma services that usually is challenged first is the what I call the earlier stage projects, the higher science stuff that's years away from being revenue for your client, right? If you're the outsource vendor, the stuff that tends to get cut last is the stuff they have in their projections, the client has in their projections as being next year's revenue. And so the things that focus on running your phase three, your last phase of clinical trials, the things that are around outsourcing commercialization services around once the drug's already been approved, those are the things that are the least likely to be touched by a pending recession. And of course, if the recession's long enough, the problems work their way through the snake as it goes. But we hope that those recessions aren't too long and too lasting. But I do think as I look ahead over 10 and 20 years that this trend to outsource in this space, the dynamics that we talked about of private equity finding this space attractive, not just healthcare private equity, but financial services and business process outsourcing, generalist PEs find it attractive and are investing. And that's sort of moving up the chain from small vendors consolidation to folks spinning back out after they're acquired, doing it all over again. It feels like a good long run space, and certainly is here at NanoMed for us to continue investing in through the cycles.
It's a fascinating sector, and your insights on it have been super interesting and a ton of fun. Bijan, thank you for joining us in this episode, and hope you listen to the next ones coming
up. Thanks so much, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us on this installment of The Capital Corner. To learn more about today's discussion, please email host Jeff Cockrell at gcockrell@mcguirewoods.com. We look forward to hearing from you. This series was recorded and is being made available by McGuire Woods for informational purposes only. By accessing this series, you acknowledge that McGuire Woods makes no warranty, guarantee, or representation as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this installment. The views, information, or opinions expressed are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily reflect those of McGuire Woods. This series should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice from a licensed professional attorney in your state, and should not be construed as an offer to make or consider any investment or course of action.